Sir, for giving me this opportunity to present this topic to the August Assembly. I hope everybody is keeping well in this difficult time. So today we will discuss about proliferative glomerular diseases. Quite a huge topic, so I will try to go slow and I will try to discuss things on a case-based approach. So this is the disclaimer. The contents of this talk include various diagrams and figures from different published papers which have been cited. And the images are mostly clicked by me as a practicing renal pathologist. And my sincere thanks to Professor Dr. Ritambara Nagar, who was my mentor and guide in PGIM at Chandigarh. And I would like to start my talk in a very positive and very cheerful note. This was taken in 2014, as you can see, Dr. Ritambara, myself, don't look at me, Dr. Devashish, who will also be presenting, we are successively presenting things, Dr. Mahesha, a doyen of renal pathology, who is here today, and Dr. Ashwini, who is a PhD guide and who is a key person behind the success of a nephropath in PGIM. He is a very important person in our lab, and I am really grateful to my entire team, Dr. Suvendu, who is my colleague nephropathologist, and Dr. Sandeep, who is my nephrologist, is a very nice person, and my entire team of technicians, my residents and my faculty. So as I have said that I will go on in a case-based manner. Before coming to first case, I would like to just a quick recap of what we have already discussed in the previous class. Dr. Devashish has told you already about the non-proliferative glomerular diseases. Before that, we have told you what is proliferation. We see proliferation mostly in the form of mesangial proliferation or endocapillary proliferation or extracapillary proliferation, which is equivalent to crescents. Crescentic glomerulonephritis, which is defined by more than 50% of the glomeruli showing crescent at any phase, will be discussed in the next class by Dr. Devashish. I will be discussing and focusing mostly on mesangial and endocapillary proliferative lesions without crescents. It can be associated with crescents as well. Now, before I progress in my talk, let me tell you that whenever we talk about proliferative diseases, usual presentation is nephritic, sometimes nephrotic nephritic, but pure nephrotic form of presentation is kind of rare. So if you see a proliferative glomerular diseases, kind of you can expect that the patient is probably presenting with a nephritic kind of illness, which what is it I will describe in a few moments. The other thing that I want to tell you, that whenever we say that this is a mesangial proliferative glomerulonephritis or a membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis or a diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, I want to tell you that these are essentially patterns. So when I say this is DPGN or diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, I tend to say that this is the pattern. When I say this is membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, this is basically a pattern which we identify in histopathology. So I can say that this is the MPGN pattern, and then I put on PIF, I put on electron microscopy, I put on other tests, clinical history, and then I try to point out that what is the disease which is causing this particular pattern or MPGN pattern or DPGN pattern. So at the beginning, DPGN, MPGN, I mean diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis, mesangial proliferative glomerulonephritis, membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, they are not really disease entities, they are just the patterns. But from the pattern, we can deduce what disease or which disease is actually causing this particular pattern. So with that, case one. So, a 10-year, these are the two kind of history. So 10-year male child who presented with headache, oliguria and smoky urine. So there was a history of sore throat which occurred 3 weeks back, and there was periorbital puffiness, bipedal pitting edema and hypertension. And when we examined the urine RBCs, there was almost 150 to 200 RBCs in the urine. So there was hematuria, and that is possibly causing this smoky urine. And there was also subnephrotic range proteinuria, which means a proteinuria which is less than 3 gram per day. So this is the morphology that we can see in low magnification. You can see that concentrated on the glomerular compartment, you can see the glomeruli are quite large and they are very, very cellular in this magnification. I showed you the normal morphology, so this glomerulus or this glomerulus is way too cellular. Also, just please look at the tubular interstitial compartment. These tubules, you can see that the lining is quite flattened. And note these tubules which are containing some pigment casts within it, right? So that is the evidence that hematuria was there. PA stain, to highlight this huge degree of cellularity, you can see that there is lobular accentuation, and even in this magnification you can clearly identify mesangial hypercellularity. Endocapillary loop is patent here, but it is obliterated here. And majority of the glomerulus in this field, you can see 1, 2, 3 and 4 glomerulus, glomeruli, and all of which are actually involved by the disease process. Another cut of a glomerulus is also visible, and possibly it was showing some crescent formation. Now again, the higher magnification to show the lobular accentuation, you cannot see the endocapillary loop here. So there is endocapillary as well as mesangial hypercellularity. You can see the flattening or simplification of the tubular epithelium. So there is acute tubular injury, some degree of edema in the interstitium, and also pigment casts within the tubules. This Nasson trichrome stain, you can nicely see the pigment casts, and a little bit of crescent is becoming visible in this magnification. This is the silver stain, which can very nicely highlight the endocapillary and mesangial hypercellularity. But please note, in this magnification also you can see the crescent here, but please note that the basement membrane, the glomerular basement membrane, is not really thickened. So as you can see from the clinical history also, that the disease has hit possibly 3 weeks back, and it is now involving the glomerular compartment. So probably the disease has not got enough time for thickening of the glomerular basement membrane, and that's why the remodeling and deposition, they are not taking place at a huge level so as to cause a glomerular basement membrane thickening. So this is a very important clue. Even with lobular accentuation and hypercellularity at the mesangial as well as endocapillary compartment, when you see a normal looking glomerular basement membrane, we tend to label it as diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis pattern. So what are the causes when we see such pattern? What are the important causes that come to our mind? Number one is post-streptococcal or infection related glomerulonephritis, as well as C3 glomerulopathy. So with this in mind, we went ahead with the direct immunofluorescence. Here you can see granular deposits in the mesangium as well as in the capillary loop. And if you look very minutely to the deposits, you can see that the deposits are both coarse as well as fine. It's a little patchy, it's not very uniform. And I've mentioned that there was a predominantly C3 deposit more than that of immune IgG. So this can still be a C3 glomerulopathy, or it could be a post-streptococcal or infection-related glomerulonephritis. I have taken a picture from Heptinstall to show the classical lumpy bumpy kind of deposit, which means very coarse and fine patchy kind of deposits, which we expect in infection related, or rather let us not confuse, post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis. Now this patient turned out to have positive ASO titer and ANA ANCA was negative. So these are important tests, serological tests, that usually are accompanied when we report such cases. So with ASO titer positivity, obviously our suspicion was acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. And if you look at the electron microscopic picture, you see in the last class I have already described, I have already shown you how to demonstrate, how to interpret electron microscopic picture. So this is the glomerular basement membrane, nice and fine. you can see a little bit of endothelial cell processes and the fenestrations. And this is the podocyte nucleus with podocytic foot processes. Now just try to see that there is a huge electron dense deposit which is black in color, basically of immune complex type, in between the glomerular basement membrane and the foot process of the podocyte. The foot process of the podocyte is kind of lifted upwards from the glomerular basement membrane by this deposit. So this is known as a subepithelial hump. And this is also a very important clue that the subepithelial hump is also occurring at the paramesangial region or the mesangial waist region. So with this morphological feature, and this is just to show the schematic diagram, you can also see some degree of subepithelial deposit here and dominantly the subepithelial hump. So basically what we see is a diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis pattern, because along with a C3 dominant deposit, which was kind of lumpy bumpy, C3 was more than IgG, and there was subepithelial hump in electron microscopy with some scattered subendothelial deposit with positive ASO titer, negative ANA and ANCA profile. So we can safely diagnose this case on the clinical context as acute post-infectious or post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis with crescent. So here just I want to tell you, we have seen a crescent out of, I have shown you around 4 glomeruli at least, and out of which only one glomerulus was showing a little bit of crescent. So this we cannot diagnose as crescentic glomerulonephritis, because only 25% of the glomerulus is showing the crescent. So we label such cases as acute some glomerulonephritis, acute post-infectious glomerulonephritis with crescents. Please remember, in majority of the cases when post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis occurs, the sore throat or the skin infection which has precipitated the illness has actually regressed, and there is no infection, active infection in the body at that particular time. Right? So, just to highlight in brief, we have already discussed these things. What is the difference between nephritic and nephrotic syndrome? Obviously, you know that there is a strict definition of nephrotic syndrome, which is which we have discussed. In nephritic syndrome, we tend to see hematuria, oliguria and hypertension, which are absent in nephrotic syndrome. The edema in nephrotic syndrome is more generalized, whereas nephritic syndrome, it is usually not that extensive, but it's not really watertight. Then obviously in nephritic syndrome, the proteinuria is of subnephrotic range, which is of nephrotic range in nephrotic syndrome. The one of the very basic tests by which nephritic and nephrotic can be distinguished is the urine sediment, which is active, means containing RBCs and RBC casts and leukocytes and granulocytic casts in nephritic syndrome. In nephrotic syndrome, you tend to see either no casts or hyaline or broad casts. So these are the differences between nephritic and nephrotic syndrome. So what causes this acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis? I will just briefly discuss the pathogenesis of the disease. So usually there is an antecedent throat infection or a skin infection by a group A streptococcus or GAS gas, Streptococcus pyogenes that is. There are some particular strains which are known as nephritogenic strains, which means that these strains actually promote glomerulonephritis. And for throat infection, the common strains are type 12, type 4 and type 1, and for skin infection they are 49, 42 and 2. And these particular strains have some proteins in their structure, in their cell wall, in their capsule, wherever, which actually elicit an antibody response. Now these antibodies, which are directed actually against these bacterial proteins, cross-react with some of the host antigens. And this cross-reaction may be because of molecular mimicry or other processes affect the host proteins. And then there is antigen-antibody complex formation, antigen-antibody complex formation, complement cascade activation, and there is acute inflammation. So this is these are the steps of acute glomerulonephritis in a post-streptococcal setting. Just to give you the names of these nephritogenic streptococcal antigens, the most common is obviously M protein. Other than that, streptokinase, endostreptosin, streptococcal pyrogenic exotoxin V, SPEV, these are the common nephritogenic antigens. Do not think that Streptococcus is the only bacteria or only organism which can promote this, but there are lot of other bacteria, virus, fungi, parasites which can cause, which are the non-streptococcal causes of this acute glomerulonephritis. That's why we do not always say post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis. In fact, in the nomenclature also I have highlighted that. Also, the shunt endocarditis, the shunt associated glomerulonephritis, endocarditis, infectious endocarditis associated GN, staphylococcal associated GN, these are also glomerulonephritis, these are also post-infectious kind of glomerulonephritis. Now, when we say that this is a post-infectious acute glomerulonephritis, we assume that the infection is not active in the host. But with time, even in the developing countries like us, we have seen less and less cases of PSGN or post-infectious glomerulonephritis. Obviously, in developed countries, the incidence of post-infectious glomerulonephritis is really less. In contrast, in developed countries, they tend to see infection-related or infection-associated glomerulonephritis, and the basic difference in the clinical scenario is the active infection is there in the host when the glomerulonephritis occurs. Majority of this glomerulonephritis shows IgA deposition, dominant IgA deposition, and often they are associated with staphylococcus. So they are known as IgA dominant staphylococcal infection related glomerulonephritis, or simply infection-related glomerulonephritis or infection-associated glomerulonephritis. So, essentially, majority of the cases are coagulase-positive Staph aureus, but it can also be caused by CONS or coagulase-negative Staph aureus. They are often very difficult to treat. I mean, the infection is very difficult to control because they are methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Sometimes they are methicillin-resistant Staph epidermidis, which are very, very difficult to treat, and there are clones like vancomycin resistant Staph aureus or Staph epidermidis, which are VRAC and VRAC, so are difficult to treat diseases. And if you do not control the infection, you really cannot control the glomerulonephritis. So, more commonly, these diseases occur in developed countries. Essentially, the elderly with known comorbidities like diabetes mellitus or some form of malignancy or some other debilitating illnesses are predisposed to such diseases. Usually, there is ongoing active infection and there is an IgA predominance or codominance. Before I move on to another case, I just want to highlight this is kind of an older classification proposed by Sodger based on the direct immunofluorescence pattern of PSAGN or post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis. Nowadays, we do not really see such classical pictures, but often questions are being asked in postgraduate trainees. So, if you look at these deposits, these are in black and white. If you look at these deposits, they are very patchy. There are very coarse and clumped, confluent kind of deposits, and some are very small, tiny here and there. So this kind of pattern in direct immunofluorescence in post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis is known as starry sky pattern. So here and there stars are there, and usually it occurs at the early stage of the disease. If you look at the electron microscopic picture of the corroborative electron microscopic picture of this pattern, you tend to see similar kind of subepithelial humps, but they are very spatially distributed, means here and there. In contrast, this deposit, if you look at it, they are quite confluent, almost like a sausage kind of deposit, very large and very confluent kind, almost looking like a garland. So this is known as the Gerland pattern, and usually this kind of deposits, because it involves a very large area of the glomerular basement membrane, they present with heavy proteinuria and not really the nephritic kind of, a classical nephritic kind of picture, but rather a mixed kind of a clinical presentation, nephritic, nephrotic. And you tend to see subepithelial humps, but they are very often found. If you look at the density of the deposits, they are almost continuous, even at the electron microscopic level. When the disease resolves, this kind of disease, a post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis, usually resolves even without treatment in its natural course. And at the time of resolution, you see mostly the mesangial patterns. Why? Because the deposits from the glomerular basement membrane are usually eaten up by the macrophages and microphages, and there is usually resolution, but mesangium is some area which is not very easily accessed by the inflammatory cells, so some deposit still persist in the mesangial region. So this is known as the mesangial pattern. Of course, this is in the late or resolving stage of the disease, and you can see dominantly mesangial immune complex deposits. So I have described the pattern, which is known as diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis pattern. A major clue in the histomorphology is its lobular accentuation, endocap, and mesangial proliferation. But please remember to look at the glomerular basement membrane, which is usually not thickened. Sometimes you can see variable thickening, but definitely not a split. The clinical context is very, very important for diagnosis of post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis. Usually a history of throat infection or a skin infection, mostly 3 to 4 weeks prior to this kind of illness. Usually there is hypocomplementemia, which means that the C3 level is really, really low, because the C3 is consumed in the formation of antigen-antibody complex. And you tend to see a C3 dominant pattern, usually lumpy, bumpy kind of deposit in direct immunofluorescence. And if you have the facility for doing ultrastructural examination, that is transmission electron microscopy, you tend to see subepithelial humps. So you, and obviously in clinical context, ASO titer positivity or anti-DNA-SB positivity is very important. ANA ANCA has to be negative mandatorily for this diagnosis. Why I am repeatedly stressing this ASO titer and clinical context, I will discuss when I will discuss about C3 glomerulopathy. Right. So this is the second case, where the 10-year male, which is replaced by now 24-year male, so an young adult, presented with red-colored urine, so macroscopic hematuria possibly. But here, there is no history of sore throat. Remember, there can be a vague history of sore throat in some cases, and there is no history of drug intake. Again, similar kind of hypertension, periorbital puffiness, and bipedal pitting edema. And exactly same urinary finding, hematuria and subnephrotic proteinuria. And if you look at the microscopy, you can see that the mesangial matrix is a little more, and if you count very meticulously, possibly there are 4 mesangial cell nucleus, but please try to appreciate that the endocapillary loops are absolutely normal. Again, another picture. Now you count the number of nuclei, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So there is definitely mesangial hypercellularity in this particular area. But look at the endocapillary loop, that means inside the capillary, which are very much patent. Again, so you can see that the mesangial hypercellularity is very striking. And there is some endocap, but not dominantly it's a mesangial hypercellularity pattern. I have tried to show you the mesangial hypercellularity. Here also, you tend to see this pigment cast inside the tubule. So again, the evidence that RBCs are being excreted. So this is very clear cut evidence in the biopsy. Obviously, with this kind of pattern, we diagnose this pattern as mesangioproliferative or mesangial hypercellularity pattern. So obviously with this pattern, we have to have some common differentials of or common diseases which can cause this pattern. Number one is obviously IgA nephropathy. A young male with hypertension, hematuria, and mesangial proliferative pattern, always think first in terms of IgA nephropathy, which is the commonest glomerulonephritis worldwide as well as in India. The second one is lupus nephritis, obviously class 2 usually. I will discuss later on. And again, C3 glomerulopathy, which can show almost any kind of pattern. Lupus, C3 glomerulopathy, and also IgA nephropathy can show you any kind of pattern. So these are the common differentials in majority of the cases. So with this, let us see. We looked into the vessels, which showed quite a bit of medial hypertrophy. So it is an indirect evidence of the hypertension. And when we see such medial hypertrophy, although it is not particularly relevant, for it can occur in post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis, it can occur in IgA nephropathy, it can also occur in lupus, but we also start thinking, okay, could it be an IgA nephropathy? But definitely, you have to do a direct immunofluorescence for the diagnosis of IgA nephropathy. You cannot diagnose IgA nephropathy without doing an immunofluorescence or IHC type of thing. So you see that IgG is really negative, whereas IgA is glowing along with C3. And look at the type of deposit. It is not only mesangial, the mesangial is dominant, but also it is kind of encroaching onto the glomerular capillary loops. C1Q is not really glowing, and you can see that lambda is very much dominant. Usually in IgA nephropathy, you see a lambda dominance than more than that of kappa, and electron microscopy, you can see a lot of mesangial immune complex type deposits, which are electron dense type, whereas the glomerular capillary loop is kind of normal. So with this, obviously this is a case of IgA nephropathy. So it's the most prevalent chronic glomerular disease worldwide and in India. Young male, isolated gross hematuria, hypertension, subnephrotic proteinuria, and renal failure, these are the commonest manifestations of IgA nephropathy. Please beware of this disease. It's really, really rampant. It's really, really common in our routine practice. Obviously, IgA nephropathy can present as symptomatic, as we have already discussed. Also, it can be asymptomatic, and there can be lanthanic deposits. There is usually environmental trigger as well as a genetic predisposition. Let me discuss a little bit of pathogenesis of IgA nephropathy, which is a very common disease in our practice. So this is an article with Suzuki's article, which is a very, very good article. If you want to know about IgA nephropathy pathogenesis, you can go through this article really. So they have described that there are four hits. The first hit is, in IgA nephropathy, the basic defect is at the genetic level, and there is formation of IgA1, which is deficient in galactose. So if you look at the IgA1 molecule, there is something called hinge region. So the variable region of any heavy chain, and the constant region are usually joined by a hinge. This hinge region in IgA1, that is a subtype of IgA, usually contains a lot of proteins which have galactose chains attached to it. Now in IgA1, there is a deficiency of galactose. So it leads to production of galactose deficient type of IgA1. Now, this deficiency of galactose actually forms kind of a new epitope in the IgA1 molecule. This new epitope can be recognized by the IgA1 itself or the IgG of the patient. So, it's kind of an autoimmune reaction. So what is happening is the IgA1 is defective in the form of aberrant glycosylation, which is forming a new epitope, because the protein which is forming because of this aberrant glycosylation is something which is not recognized as self by the immune system. So the IgA1 itself or the IgG can recognize this IgA1 new epitope or new epitope. So this IgA1 attacks another IgA1, just like a dog kind of trying to catch its own tail. And there is formation of antigen-antibody complex. Please remember, here the antigen is IgA1 and another IgA1 molecule is the antibody. So the antigen and antibody can be actually same in terms of clonality. So this antigen-antibody complex formation occurs, and this immune complex can deposit in the mesangium. Now, it is possible that this defective IgA is first absorbed onto the mesangium, and then the antibody, which is also IgA1 or IgG, can come and attack there, or the immune complex is formed in the circulation and gets deposited in the mesangium. So mesangium, majority of the time, is an innocent bystander which is affected by this autoimmune process. So frankly speaking, mesangium can simply say, I have nothing to do with it, but I am getting affected by this wars between the kings. So this immune complex deposition in the mesangium actually promotes complement cascade. Usually IgA typically elicits an alternative pathway activation and sometimes lectin pathway activation. So the complement which is definitely will be there is C3, because it's an alternative complement pathway response. And whenever this cascade is activated, it incites the inflammatory cells, the monocytes, the macrophages, the mesangial cells themselves start behaving like macrophages, the neutrophils, etc., which start pouring into the mesangium. They release cytokines. These cytokines cause proliferation of the mesangial cells further, and this brings onto the mesangial hypercellularity and the disease. So if you look at this four hits, there is first hit is the galactose deficient IgA1 production, which obviously is controlled by the genetics of the patient, and then formation of the antibodies, which are anti-glycan antibodies, formation of the immune complex, which is the third hit, and deposit in the mesangium, which is fourth hit. Obviously then you can see proliferation, cytokines, CCM production, etc. Now let me tell you one thing, that not only the genetics play a role, there are some environmental factors as well. That's why when I say that sore throat, there is not a history of sore throat in this patient, but sometimes sore throat can be an antecedent illness, because sometimes we have seen that the viral infection or even a bacterial infection predispose IgA nephropathy. Why? Because whenever such illness occurs, the body is triggered to produce more and more IgA at the mucosal level as well as the serum level. Now, this IgA1, this galactose deficient IgA1 in a genetically predisposed host has an exaggerated polymeric IgA1 response, which is prolonged as well, but this IgA1 is of low affinity to clear the infection. So now you have a polymeric IgA1 response which is prolonged and exaggerated and is low affinity. So you see that the antigen clearance becomes defective. Moreover, because of this defective or aberrant glycosylation, the IgA1 molecules tend to self-aggregate forming larger molecules. So there is a difference in the IgA1 electrostatic charge. So IgA1 tends to polymerize and form larger complex molecules. So what is the problem when there is larger molecules and there is defective clearance? There is formation of macromolecules of IgA which are difficult to be eaten up and taken up and cleared from the circulation. So you see that the IgA clearance becomes defective. So in a genetically predisposed individual with a right kind of environmental insult, you tend to see that such large molecules of IgA are difficult to be cleared by ACLO glycoprotein receptors which are present on the hepatocytes in the space of DSA. Now if you go back and read the anatomy of space of DSA, it's a potential space, it's not a space, it's a potential space. And this space becomes too small for the entry of such macromolecules. So the hepatocytes cannot take up these IgA molecules. And also the myeloid cells cannot clear it. So the polymeric IgA becomes more and more in the host, and there is deposition promoting the IgA nephropathy. So to classify IgA nephropathy, when we see the biopsy of IgA nephropathy, there is an classification which was proposed in 2009, and they have found that there are four main morphological parameters which actually correlate to the prognosis of the disease. These are known as MEST. M for mesangial hypercellularity, whether that is present or not, because I have said that IgA nephropathy can show you any morphology. Please remember that IgA nephropathy can show you absolutely normal morphology, and you can only detect the disease by doing a direct immunofluorescence. There is no other way. So mesangial hypercellularity, if it is there, it is usually a poor prognostic marker, number one. Segmental glomerulosclerosis, Devashish has already taken you about FSGS. Please remember that FSGS kind of morphology can also be seen in IgA nephropathy, and if it is present, usually the patients tend to progress more towards renal failure. However, the most classical or most linear kind of correlation is seen with the tubular atrophy interstitial fibrosis, also known as IFTA, which means if you tend to see long interstitial fibrosis with tubular atrophy, then the disease is already progressing and the patients will progress to renal failure earlier. Now, endocapillary hypercellularity is not really predictive of disease progression, but it has been seen that if you have endocapillary hypercellularity, those diseases respond nicely with immunosuppression, especially steroids. So this is also a predictive marker of IgA nephropathy. So this is the MEST. In the recent most classification, people have seen that the presence or absence of crescent is a very, very important prognostic marker. If there is presence of crescent in IgA nephropathy, again, it's a poor prognostic marker. Also, in the recent classification, people have seen that the presence of podocyte hypertrophy or tip lesions in this segmental glomerulosclerosis is also kind of correlate with a poor prognosis in IgA nephropathy. So this particular classification, which is the modification of Oxford classification, is known as MEST C classification. So for the postgraduates, you don't have to really know about MEST C classification, but for theoretical purpose, please know that IgA nephropathy can show you any kind of pattern: mesangial hypercellularity pattern, endocapillary hypercellularity pattern. It can even show you FSGS kind of pattern, and it can show you also crescentic kind of pattern. Also, I have already discussed that there can be absolutely normal pattern, normal morphology, which can only be detected by IgA direct immunofluorescence. Right. So, what is the difference between IgA nephropathy and Hinox-Schönlein purpura? it's sometimes considered to be the same spectrum of diseases, although Enoxaparin Purpura usually present with a lot of extra renal symptoms, not only renal symptoms in the form of skin purpura or GI bleed, etc. And in kidney, they can show you lot of crescents, usually presents in the children and presents who are less than 15 years. And usually they have more nephrotic syndrome kind of presentation. Immunologically, Enoxaparin Purpura, the size of IgA immune complexes are really, really large in contrast to IgA nephropathy. Also, the major clue when we look at the biopsies of Enoxaparin Purpura is that you tend to see a lot of crescents usually, and when you look at the deposits usually not only involve the mesangium but also the glomerular capillary loops, and the electron microscopy will also show you electron dense deposits in the mesangium as well as a lot of deposits in the subendothelial and subepithelial compartments. So now I move on to the third case. You see that in IgA nephropathy, I was talking of a 24-year male with hematuria and subnephrotic kind of proteinuria, but here it's a 24-year female. So a young female with hematuria and subnephrotic proteinuria. Again, no history of sore throat or drug intake. ESO titer is negative, so I'm trying to tell you that possibly it's not a post-reproductive glomerulonephritis. But here ANA, DLTNA and ANCA, these are awaited. The clinicians didn't provide us with this detail, but he could provide us with the fact that there is hypocomplementemia, which is the way to say that possibly this is some disease where the complements are being consumed in huge quantity. When you look at this biopsy, you can see very nicely that there is lobular accentuation. You cannot really see the endocapillary loops. There is definitely mesangial and endocapillary hypercellularity. You can see that these are the visceral podocytes, which are very, very large. So there is podocyte prominence, which means they are reacting. And the next thing that we should do is look at the glomerular basement membrane. Again, before looking at the glomerular basement membrane, just another picture in PS to show the huge degree of mesangial as well as endocapillary hypercellularity and nice club-shaped lobules in the glomeruli. Now you look at the glomerular basement membrane. Unlike the previous case of DPGN, just look at the glomerular basement membrane, which is showing a nice split. Can you see the nice split? And obviously there is glomerular basement membrane thickening. So this must be a disease which has, of course, progressed for quite some time. It cannot be an acute heat disease. It must have caused glomerular remodeling. It cannot be an acute disease. So in our mind, post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis is really, really becomes lower down the card, because it's not really an acute glomerulonephritis. You can see the nice split over here. And also, this is the PS positive material which is deposited in the glomerular basement membrane. So obviously this is the kind of deposit which has occurred in the glomerular basement membrane. So there is nice deposit in the glomerular basement membrane. So with this kind of morphology, you see that there is membrane, there is proliferation, which is mesangial as well as endocapillary, and the membrane is also thickened and showing split. So this is called a membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis pattern or MPGN pattern. So what are the major differentials of MPGN pattern? Again, first clue is lupus nephritis. Young female, obviously we have to think in terms of lupus nephritis. Usually the proliferative classes of lupus nephritis, class 3 and class 4. The second one, again, C3 glomerulopathy. One of the commonest manifestation of C3 glomerulopathy is MPGN pattern and idiopathic MPGN, where the causes cannot be really found. So With this, I just want to discuss about the NPGN pattern. Previously, even I think 10-12 years back, we tend to say that this is NPGN, which means NPGN as a disease entity. But this was a seminal article back in 2012, which Sanjeev Sethi and Favenza has published in New England Journal of Medicine, where they have looked upon the NPGN disease or membrane proliferative glomerulonephritis and tried to say that, see, NPGN is a pattern. The disease is something else. It's like fever. It's a symptom. You have to trace back from this pattern and diagnose the diseases. So, when we do the direct immunofluorescence for NPGN pattern, we either see an immune complex mediated pattern, which means immune complex deposition, or we see complement deposition only. So, immune complex deposition means you see IgG, IgA, C3, C1q, kappa lambda, all these kind of deposits. Or you tend to see only deposition of CE3. So now look at this nice schematic diagrams that are given in this NEJM article. When you have an immune complex mediated NPGN, just like lupus nephritis, you have IgG or IgM which activate the complement, which is C1 or C1q. So this means the starting point is C1q, means this is activating the classical complement pathway. This leads on to the formation of C4B2A and C3 convertase, C5 convertase, and there is deposition of membrane attack complex, right? Whenever there is deposition of this membrane attack complex, the monocytes and neutrophils, they come, they release the reactive oxygen species, proteases, which cause damage to the glomerular basement membrane, leading on to the proliferative phase, what we see just now, the morphology, what we have seen, that kind of stage. And then, you see that these immune complexes, these molecules, even this inflammatory cells, they come in this in contact with this glomerular basement membrane, and at this point of time there is an attempt to healing. So there is formation of a new glomerular basement membrane, there is formation of a neobasement membrane formation, and these complexes are deposited in between the old and damaged basement membrane and the new basement membrane, giving rise to the split. Just look back at this split in this region. Now you know that what kind of material are there inside the split. So they are not taking up the color of pH, and that's why the split is there. In contrast, when you look at a complement mediated NPGN, it starts with the alternative complement pathway. There is usually C3. Now, let me tell you about the alternative complement pathway in a little detail. In host, even in our blood, the C3 itself gets fragmented into C3B and C3A. This spontaneous degradation of C3 constantly occurs at a low level. So there is some degree of C3 convertase activity in the blood, right? And this spontaneous degradation is known as the tick over mechanism, tick over of the C3. But the body keeps a check in this fluid phase so that more C3 convertase is not formed. And this check is mediated by molecules like complement factor H, complement factor I. So these are the inhibitory molecules which prevent the C3 convertase from formation at a massive scale. Whenever there is formation of massive scale of C3 convertase, it further propagates the cascade, forming the membrane attack complex. Now, how to produce massive scale of C3 converters? You just inhibit the CFH, the factor H, which is the inhibitory molecule. By it means either by a mutation of factor H, or you put an inhibitory antibody to against factor H, so that factor H is inhibited or nullified, so that now the C3 converters does not have a factor H inhibition. So there will be massive scale production of C3 converters. The other thing could be, you can simply do the same kind of thing for complement factor I. I mean, you produce either a mutation of factor I or produce an antibody against it. That also will do. Other thing, you produce an antibody against the C3 converters enzyme, which kind of stabilizes the C3 converters, so that the C3 converters is now not degraded or in the circulation. It is stabilized, it is constantly functioning, C3 is constantly broken and forming the membrane attack complex. So that's the mechanism of a complement mediated cascade which occurs in complement mediated MPGN, right? So in short, when we look at the MPGN pattern, we either get an immune complex deposit in terms of deposits, or only complement, especially C3. So when you find immune complexes, there can be three important causes. Number one, infections like hepatitis C, which is one of the commonest infection causing MPGN pattern. The second is autoimmune disease or rheumatologic diseases. Of course, SLE is the classical example. Rheumatoid arthritis is the classical example. Cryoglobulinemia is a classical example of such pattern. The third one is monoclonal gammopathy or dysproteinemia or paraproteinemia associated MPGN, right? When we see only complements, I mean C3 deposits only, then we diagnose this disease as C3 glomerulopathy, and then we go forward with electron microscopy, and if we find in electron microscopy a particular pattern, we label it as dense deposit disease or C3 glomerulonephritis, and then we go forward with looking at the complement pathways and mutations of antibodies, which I have already discussed. So in this particular case, which I have already discussed, we could see that there are this kind of eosinophilic refractory deposit in H&E stain, and there are formation of this kind of ring-like material. So obviously, this is a very classical clue for C3, the C3 glomerulopathy or dense deposit disease even. And when we look at the C3, you can see that nice granular mesangial deposits of C3. Somewhere it is also in the along the capillary loops, and all other immunoglobulins and complements are negative. So with this, we can diagnose it as C3 glomerulopathy. But then we have to do electron microscopy, and if we find intramembranous sausage shaped and very very electron dense deposit, this kind of black deposit along the membrane, we label it as dense deposit disease. The name is self-explanatory. And when we see kind of deposits in subendothelial space, intramembranous, subepithelial, mesangial, elsewhere, and the texture of the deposit is not as dense, it is kind of immune complex type of deposit, then we label it as C3 glomerulonephritis. So there are two limbs of C3 GP, which are known as dense deposit disease and C3 glomerulonephritis. So now let me tell you, when we discussed about post-streptococcal acute glomerulonephritis, we said that it is a C3 dominant disease, and sometimes it can only show you C3. So how can you distinguish it from the C3 glomerulopathy from post-infectious glomerulonephritis? Essentially, you have to have clinical clues in terms of ASO titer, anti-DNA, ASB titer, etc. You have to have electron you have to have electron microscopy to see whether there is dense deposit or not, because you cannot essentially, there is not much difference between C3GN and acute post-streptococcal GN, and the clinical context, how the patients presented, etc. But still there are a lot of gray zone areas in this. So some people report it as glomerulonephritis with dominant C3 in short of electron microscopy and other parameters available. Now, this is just the extension of the case 3. I have shown you the same MPGN pattern. The case history was same, 24-year female, etc. This was the case history. But now I have added that the patient had butterfly rash, arthritis, and polyspherocytes. And at this point of time, ANA and dsDNA is positive, ANCA is negative. Previously, the ANA and ANCA was awaited by the clinicians. Hypocomplementemia is still present. So, similar kind of clinical picture, only we have added the classical picture of lupus along with ANA positivity and dsDNA positivity. And when you look at such biopsies, the direct immunofluorescence of such biopsies, this is known as the full house pattern. Look at the electron microscopy and you tend to see subendothelial deposit, subepithelial deposit and intramembranous deposit. These are the nice immune complex type of electron dense deposit in the subendothelium, subepithelium and along the membranous. You can see this is the intramembranous deposit, right? And when you look at the endothelial cells, sometimes if you are very keen in observation, you can see such grape-like clusters or fingerprint-like clusters, which are known as tubulo-reticular inclusion. They are not specific for anything, but when you see this, they kind of tell you that, okay, we are possibly dealing with a case of lupus nephritis. So, with this, let me tell you that lupus nephritis is histopathologically classified into six classes. The first class is the minimal mesangial, which means that morphologically you barely see anything. It's kind of normal morphology. However, when you do direct immunofluorescence, you tend to see a full house pattern restricted to the mesangial component, and sometimes you can see a little bit of paramesangial deposits as well. But histomorphologically you see kind of normal morphology and no mesangial proliferation or endocapillary proliferation is a no-no for this kind of type 1 or minimal mesangial type of lupus nephritis. Of course, the patients are often asymptomatic at this point of time and this is rarely biopsied. If you have almost 100 cases of lupus nephritis, you hardly see one or two cases and maybe even less than one cases of type 1 lupus nephritis. The second one is the class 2 lupus nephritis, also known as mesangioproliferative lupus nephritis. The pattern is what I showed you in the case 2. It's limited to the mesangial part only, and the direct immunofluorescence is also limited to mesangial part only. The granular deposits of full house in the mesangial part and not really extending onto the glomerular basement membrane. In class 3 and class 4 lupus nephritis, which are known as focal proliferative and diffuse proliferative lupus nephritis, the morphology is kind of same. It will show you the DPGN or MPGN kind of pattern. You can see lot of mesangial endocapillary proliferation, you can see crescents, you can see wire loops, which are basically massive subendothelial deposits. I will show you the picture, etc. But you count the number of glomeruli involved in a particular core. If it is less than 50%, then you say this is focal proliferative lupus nephritis or class 3 lupus nephritis. And if more than 50% glomeruli are involved, then we call it a diffuse proliferative lupus nephritis or class 4 lupus nephritis. If you tend to see just morphologically just an MGN pattern, same kind of thickened diffusely and globally thickened and stiffened capillary loops, just like a membranous glomerulonephritis, and a full house pattern in direct immunofluorescence. This is known as a classical class 5 lupus or membranous type of lupus nephritis. The class 6 lupus nephritis is the advanced sclerotic lupus nephritis, which involves more than 90% of the glomeruli, which are globally sclerosed because of the disease process per se. Now, just to schematically show you, the deposit in class 1 is limited only to the mesangium, but look at the cellularity. The cellularity in mesangium is normal. There is no deposit in the subendothelial or the subepithelial compartment, right? In class 2, which is mesangioproliferative, you see the black deposits in the mesangium, and obviously there is mesangial proliferation or hypercellularity in the form of 4 or more mesangial cells in a mesangial compartment. In class 3 or 4, you see deposits everywhere in the mesangium, in the subendothelium, and sometimes occasional deposits in the subepithelium as well. You see endocapillary proliferation, the neutrophils and the monocyte have come and clogged the endocapillary loop. So you see endocapillary proliferation as well as endocapillary as well as mesangial proliferation. So nowadays we call these as endocapillary hypercellularity, as I have previously described, and mesangial hypercellularity. In class 5, you can see mesangial deposit, but no mesangial proliferation per se, but essentially subepithelial deposit, just like membranous glomerulonephritis. So this is known as a classical class 5. There is a composite thing, which is the combination of class 3 or 4 and class 5, where you see, for class 3, class 4, you see subendothelial and mesangial deposit, and for class 5, you see subepithelial kind of deposit. Right? Okay. Please remember, they have drawn another picture for class 3, class 4. Why? Because you see that there is mesangial hypercellularity, but there is no endocapillary hypercellularity unlike this. In contrast, there is only massive subendothelial deposit. This is something which is morphologically depicted as wire loop lesion, but no endocap. Still, only wire loop lesion will also be categorized under class 3, class 4, or as a proliferative kind of lesion. So this is a peculiar scenario in lupus, where there is lot of subendothelial deposit but no endocap, but we consider this as an equivalent for endocap and label it as class 3, class 4, and not as class 2.